V'emtzoyim and the mediums, ha-magiyim es ha-odim l'tachlis ezeh, that get a person to this place, hema mitzvos are the mitzvos, asher tzivanu aleihem ha-kel yisbarach shmo, that Hashem, blessed be His name, has commanded us upon, u'makom asiyas ha-mitzvos, and the place of doing these mitzvos, hu rak olam hazeh, is only in this world. In the last session, we discussed Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas, that he had a very difficult life, so difficult that the Gemara gives us an example. A day in his life, he went for a medical procedure, and when he came back home, there was nothing to eat. He bit into a clove of garlic and passed out from malnourishment. The Rabbanan, the rabbis of a generation, came to visit, and they saw that he, in a state of unconsciousness, first he began crying, then he began laughing, then a beam of light came out of his head. I'd like to focus now on those events. Why did he cry? Why did he laugh? And what was the meaning of the beam of light? Now, the laughing is rather obvious. If you were told that your estate in the world to come is so wide and so vast that there are 13 rivers running through it, you'd also find it very humorous. Knowing that a parable is a man in our world so wealthy that he has tracts and tracts of land, knowing that that's what's awaiting for him, his world to come, would be very humorous, and I can understand why he'd laugh. The beam of light, I also understand. You see, there was a debate. He said to Hashem, 13 rivers, it's impressive, but there's more. I could accomplish even more. And he said, give me those portions who didn't earn them. And he was saying to Hashem, well, 13 rivers is nice, but I could do even more. And what he was expressing was tremendous ambition. You see, greed is ugly. Greed is self-serving and selfish. Ambition is beautiful. Ambition is shooting for the stars. Ambition is reaching high. When Hashem created the human being and put us here on the planet, Hashem did not create us for mediocrity. Hashem didn't put us here and say, well, whatever, go live your 70, 80 years, and when you're done, we'll see what happens. It doesn't really matter anyway. Hashem put us on the planet to reach stellar heights, to change ourselves and change the world we live in. Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas understood that. And he said to Hashem, 13 rivers is impressive, but there's more. I can reach even greater heights. And Hashem said, you got it. Touché. Hashem touched him on the forehead, and the beam of light came out because Hashem was, if it could be, entertained, signifying that Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas got it right. So I understand the laughing. I understand the beam of light. But why did he cry? So if you look in Rashi on that Gemara, Rashi says that he cried because Hashem told him he had passed the halfway mark. Remember, he was so troubled, he didn't know if he could continue. Hashem offered him, do you want me to turn back the world to its moment of creation? Do you want me to find you a different life? He said to Hashem, I don't know. He didn't know if he had the strength to continue. He said to Hashem, did I live half of my years? Hashem said, yes, you lived half of your years. At that point, Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas began crying. Oy vey, half of my life gone. And he begins crying. And that Rashi is rather perplexing. Why? Because this is the man who got it right. This is the man who's leading the perfect life, serving Hashem, serving his people, a man who's living the absolute perfect life. And he's halfway done. He should be dancing a jig. He should be overjoyed. Imagine a man who's running the marathon. And at 20 miles, the judges say to him, you're setting a world record. Just keep it up. Ay vey, 20 miles gone. Hoo-hoo. Why is he crying? Rabbi Elazar bar Pedas knew the Mesillas Yesharim. He knew that this world is a gym. He understood that we're here to grow, to accomplish, but this world exists strictly as the gym. And he understood that he was doing phenomenally well. The fact that he was halfway done should have been a source of joy, should have caused him to dance. Why did he cry? And I believe when we focus on this question and the answer, we'll frame life in a very different way. And to do that, I'd like to focus on not the world to come, but our life here. And to focus on our life here, let me share with you an interesting example. Chovos HaVavos gives us an example, a little bit modernized, as follows. Imagine a man who at 35 years of age loses his sight. He spends the next months, the next years, trying to recreate a life, and he succeeds to a degree. He learns how to navigate, learns how to get by, and he spends 10 years in utter blackness. After that 10-year period, he hears about an experimental procedure that, if successful, could reconnect the optic nerve. He consults with other physicians. He consults with his family. He decides to undergo the operation. He's brought to the hospital, wheeled into the operating room, put under anesthetic, and for 10 hours, the operation goes on. After a while, he begins regaining consciousness. He flexes his fists. He readies himself. He now knows what's going to be his future. He steals his fists and he goes, "Ah, ah, nurse, nurse, my eyes won't open." He calls in a nurse. The nurse comes running. "What's the matter?" "My eyes, they won't open." Of course, you have to wait 3 days. The sutures have to heal. So he waits 72 hours. Finally, after what seems like an eternity, with the doctors gathered at the foot of his bed, with his family all there, they pull off one bandage. They pull off a second bandage. He opens his eyes and he sees. He sees colors. He sees textures, dimensions. He sees his family members, faces that he hasn't seen in 10 years. He looks out a window and he sees the clouds and the sky. He sees a meadow. He sees grass. With tears in his eyes, he turns to the doctor and says, "Doctor, what could I ever do to repay you for this gift of sight?" The Chofetz Chaim explains to us that that emotion, that extraordinary joy, we're supposed to experience regularly. We say brachas every day, and those brachas are supposed to be an inventory of our riches. Pokeach Ivrim, Hashem, you give sight to the blinded. I'm supposed to open my eyes and see colors, dimensions, textures. I'm supposed to look out at a world replete with beauty, and I'm supposed to say, "Thank you, Hashem." I'm supposed to say, "Zokev Kefufim, Hashem, you straighten the crooked. I have mobility, I have arms and legs. I have fingers that feel, that touch. I have such gifts that are right here." And we human beings are a bit of a curious breed. The minute something happens, I break my arm, or Rahman al-Salam, something happens, very quickly the complaints find their address. But until that time, there was no acknowledgement, no thank you, not even a recognition that it was a gift. Until it's taken, then why Hashem, why me? Of the 6.5 billion occupants of the planet, why did you choose me? But until that point, I didn't even recognize it as a gift. And we human beings go about a life that's so replete with wonder, with gifts, and we're clueless to it. And that should be a question. Why is it that we don't appreciate things? And it's not just sight and hearing and sense of touch. Let's focus on something else. Imagine that you were to create a world. Imagine that you were the creator and you had to create a world from scratch. I imagine you'd make a rather functional world. And many of the features that we see in our world wouldn't be there. Let's take color, for example. I hate to date myself, but when I was a boy growing up, TV was black and white. Black and white TV worked. You could tell the full human drama within the gray spectrum. The good guys wore white hats, the bad guys wore black hats, and you could tell everything going on. So here's the question. Why didn't Hashem create the world in black and white? It would have functioned. It would have done its job, but that's not the world we see. We see a world with a vast array of colors. If you open up Microsoft Word and you open the color palette, you'll find 16 million shades of color. Why did Hashem do it? And the reason is, from a functionality standpoint, there was no reason. The world would function very well in black and white. But Hashem made a world of color because color is beautiful. The bee is largely colorblind. The bee is attracted by his sense of smell. He's drawn to the nectar because of the smell. The color of the rose, the color of the iris, has been created for our benefit. And when you look about this wondrous world we live in, you'll see so many features that Hashem created strictly for one reason, for us to enjoy, for us to derive benefit from. And it requires study and requires understanding. Let me share with you another example. The Stipler Gaon Zatzal Chai Olam explains that by rights, all food should taste like soggy cardboard. Food serves a nutritional benefit. I eat food for energy, for nutrients. All food should taste like potatoes or maybe brown beans, but that's not the food that we experience. The food that we eat comes in so many different flavors, aromas, textures. The question is why? from a functional standpoint, you would eat. You'd be hungry and you would eat. But that's exactly the point. From a functional standpoint, flavorless, bland food would work. But Hashem wants us to enjoy food. Hashem wants us to eat and enjoy it to derive benefit. So Hashem invested tremendous care, forethought, and wisdom to make our foods taste delicious. And let's focus on a few of those little details. When you peel an orange, you'll probably note that the orange is made up of a number of wedges. If you take apart those wedges, you'll see that you'll peel back the membrane, and you'll see that within that membrane are hundreds of little juice sacs. Well, here's the question. Why did Hashem make the orange with the membrane with those hundreds of juice sacs? If you'll tell me for the water content, I'd like to share with you that a watermelon has a similar water content as does an orange. You see, the juice sacs have nothing to do necessarily with holding the juice. Why did Hashem design it that way? All you have to do is look at one of those children's candies that have a sign on the front that says, "Bite in for a burst of flavor." You see, when you bite into the orange, you burst those hundreds of juice sacs, and you cause the flavor to explode in a burst in your mouth, and you have a very different experience. You see, it wasn't enough that Hashem made that sort of sweet, sort of citrusy, tangy flavor of the orange. Hashem wanted to enhance our enjoyment, so Hashem put the juice in juice sacs so that when you bite into it, you get that explosion of flavor. An apple is a very different experience. When you bite into an apple, you get the crunch. Why did Hashem design the apples that way? Go to your local supermarket. 75 feet long, you'll see breakfast cereals from floor to ceiling, bragging, each one claiming to be crunchier than its neighbors. Ours is crunchy. Ours is crunchier. Ours is so crunchy we even put earplugs in it so you don't deafen yourself. Why is each food manufacturer bragging that theirs is the crunchiest? Well, ask one of your children. When you pour the milk 5 minutes before they get to the breakfast cereal and they sit down and they say, "Abba, I can't eat this stuff, it's soggy," you'll understand that crunching on food is enjoyable. So Hashem designed the cellular walls of the apple to be brittle, to be hard, so that when you crunch into it, you get that enjoyment. The texture adds much to the experience, and Hashem put tremendous care and forethought. Pears and grapes, avocados, and even bananas that are mushy, because I guess some people like that experience. But here's the point. Wisdom, care, forethought, for one reason, for you to enjoy, for you to experience that enhancement. I remember one Shavuos when I opened my eyes and started laughing. Typically, most people, we stay up Shavuos night learning. I've made it a habit for many years now that when I daven Shacharis in the morning, I don't sit down. After staying up all night learning, if I sit down, I fall asleep. One Shavuos, I surprised myself because as I was standing, listening to Kriyas HaTorah, I was falling asleep standing. I would just sort of catch myself, nodding off. One point, when I opened my eyes, I started laughing. Why? Because I opened my eyes and there was the bima, and on the bima was a large bouquet of flowers, the irises, the orchids, the lilies. And I said to myself, that's astonishing. The colors, the textures, the arrangements, the veins and the structure of the flower. The bee would go to the pollen despite the color. The beauty of the flowers was created for our enjoyment. And you just see the care that went into it. If you go to a mountaintop and you look out at a world that's so replete with beauty, such an abundance of magnificence, if you study a sunrise, if you look at an ocean, put on a scuba mask and go underneath and you'll see a new world, the underwater world of beauty. And when you recognize the fact that so much of it was designed for one reason, for us to enjoy. And here's the question, do we? Do we even notice these things? Are we even cognizant? And I'd like to give you a challenge. My challenge is to tell me what your food tastes like by the fourth bite. Try this. Let's say you have one restaurant that you really love and is a particular dish that is outstanding, it's just out of this world, and you've waited months and you sit down to that dish. I challenge you to tell me what it tastes like by the fourth bite. Oh, the first bite, you're paying attention, you taste it. By the second bite, maybe. The third, By the fourth bite, you're back in conversation and you're not even aware of it. So here's the question. Hashem invested so much care and so much wisdom in making colors and flowers and beautiful scenes, flavors, aromas, textures, food with such different nuances, all for our benefit, all for our enjoyment. The question is, why don't we enjoy it? Why is it that we don't have this tremendous sense of, wow, this is astonishing? And I think there's a second question that begs being asked, particularly in our generation. And the second question is even more penetrating. The second question is, are you rich? Are you rich? I've asked that question to countless people, and invariably the answer is, rich, I'm not rich. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I'm okay, but rich, I'm not rich. Well, let's focus on this for just a moment. My grandmother, Shalom, grew up in Poland pre-World War I, and she came from a well-to-do family. She described her home. The home consisted of two rooms. One room where the parents slept, and the other room where the children slept and ate and bathed and did everything else. And believe me, the rooms were not large, and the families weren't small. They were considered well off because they had wood floors. You see, the average person living in the shtetl lived on floors made of dirt, with walls that had holes in it for the air, winter air to come in, without air conditioning, without heat, without running water. They went out in the dark of night. Regular people lived. Our relatives, our people lived. They lived such a different life than we do that it's hard to imagine, hard to compare it. My Rebbe, the Reshiva Zatzal, came to America in the right around the Depression era. And he described to me that he had a pair of shoes. And when he wore a hole in the pair of shoes, he didn't have the audacity to ask his father for the 25 cents to repair the shoes. So he figured out a solution. He took a piece of cardboard and put it inside the shoe. That way, instead of rubbing out his sock when he walked on the concrete, it rubbed against the bottom of the cardboard. And it solved the solution, a great solution, until one day he's walking in a puddle, splash, gone is his cardboard. How many people do you know who own a pair of shoes? We own pairs of shoes in brown and black and red and white, different shoes for running, different shoes for tennis, heaven forfend to play golf in running shoes. We enjoy such luxuries, wealth, abundance, that if you were to compare our lives to people living 100 years ago, there's almost no basis for comparison. And if you don't quite see this, let me share with you an example. A little bit of American history. Who was the King of England during the Revolutionary War period? The King of England was King George. And there's a rather famous portrait of King George, the monarch of England, sitting on the throne, and he's wearing this big, heavy coat. On top of that big, heavy coat is a pelt. On top of that pelt is another fur. Well, here's the question. Why is the King of England sitting on the throne wearing a heavy fur with a pelt with another cloak on top of it? Well, the answer is quite simple. You see, in those days, the way you heated a room was you had a fireplace in the front, some 50 feet away in a large anteroom. Radiant heat provides heat out this way, so the front of the king might have been warm, but the back of the king was mighty cold. So what does the king do? Turn around, now his back is warm and his front is cold. You see, the king with the crown jewels could not heat Buckingham Palace. The King of England walked dank, smelly hallways at night. The King of England lied down in 36 inches of duck feather for his bed. And you know what happens to your spine when it crinks into 36 inches of duck feather? And there are no chiropractors to put you back together in the morning. The King of England rode in the royal carriage. The royal carriage pulled by 12 white steeds, no less. Well, the royal carriage had wheels made of wood. The roads were potholed filled. Would you like to know what happens with wooden wheels on potholed filled roads? Well, if you're the King of England with the crown and the cape and the gown and the furs sitting in that royal carriage pulled by 12 white steeds, you go bump, bump, boom, because the wooden wheels shake. And the King of England shook until his insides wanted to come out. And if he had to ride to the Duke of France's wedding for 7 days straight. I drive the ultimate vanilla car. Plain old Toyota Camry. I get into my Toyota Camry and air suspension. At 60 miles an hour, it's perfectly smooth. But more than that, I have climate control in my vehicle. I've solved one of the major Shalom Bayis problems. The second largest Shalom Bayis problem in this country is what temperature do we set the thermostat at? 68, 72, we'll call a Rav, we get a Pshara. I solved it, I have dual controls. If my wife likes it warmer, I set her side higher. My model happens to come with heated seats, so I shouldn't be uncomfortable in the winter. Air conditioned and heated, power steering, power windows, so I shouldn't have to never crank too much when I want to open the windows. But even better, I have in my vehicle something that's astonishing. With a touch of a button, I get surround sound, 6 speakers. And here's the point. Who commissioned the great symphonies of history? Bach, Beethoven, Mozart. Who footed the bill? The kings and noblemen were the ones who paid for those pieces to be written, paid for them to be played. And who heard them? Nobility and wealthy people. To hear a concert back in those days, you had to be extremely affluent. If you weren't a nobleman, you went to Paris once in your life, maybe once a year, to hear a concert. With a touch of a button, I could listen to Bach or Beethoven or Miami Boys or Shweki or whatever I wish. And more than that, if I don't like the way it was put together, I hit a button in my graphic equalizer, cuts back the treble, adds in some more bass. I have my fingertips. I have luxuries, power, conveniences that kings of yesteryear couldn't imagine. The average tax-paying citizen in our world enjoys luxuries that the richest people 100 years ago, 200 years ago, for sure 300 years ago, could not envision or imagine. And yet, if you ask the average tax-paying citizen in our country, are you wealthy? Wealthy? I'm barely eking it out. Yet we have such material possessions. We have such wealth. We have racks and racks of clothing. Different clothing for this season, different clothing for that season. The Rebbe Sinza Tzal, my Rebbe's wife, told me that she grew up in Europe and she had 2 dresses, one for Shabbos and one for weekdays. I have daughters, believe me, they don't have 2 dresses. It's dresses for this color and that color and this season and that season, and it changes and it changes. We have racks and racks. I knew a woman who lived in a 3-bedroom apartment. The 3rd bedroom she converted into a closet with one of those cleaning rods that they have in the cleaners that goes around. An entire bedroom for her wardrobe. We enjoy such luxury, shoes and clothing, cars, such phenomenal material possessions, and yet we're not rich. And here's the question. We have gifts, fingers, sights, sounds, beauty, textures, aroma, flavors. We have such luxuries. We have such wealth, yet we don't enjoy them. We're not even aware that they're there. And the question is, why not? Maybe you'll tell me we have to focus on this, we have to be aware of it. I'll agree with you partly, but I think it's actually much more fundamental. It's actually much more exhibitionist of a certain attitude and a certain reality in the human. I'd like to share with you what that is. Viktor Frankl wrote a book many years ago. The book was called Man in Search of Meaning. Viktor Frankl was a Viennese psychiatrist. He didn't know that he was Jewish. The Nazis made it very clear to him when they put him on a train bound for Auschwitz. And he survived the war. When he finished the DP camp, he ended up on these shores, and he reopened his psychiatric practice on the Upper East Side. In his book, he described that when the patients came to him here, and he went through the normal intake process, he experienced something that he never had before. He was dealing with symptoms, dealing with issues that in his decades of practice before in Europe, he never had exposure to. And he describes a woman would come in and he would say, what can I do for you? Well, doc, I'm depressed. Sorry to hear that. Is it your marriage? No. Is it your children? No. Loss of a loved one? No. So why are you depressed? I don't know, doc. That's why I'm here. Middle-aged man would come in, very successful. he would say, "What could I do for you?" "Well, Doc, I'm depressed. I'm sorry to hear that. Is it your job? No. Your marriage? No. Your golf game? No. So why are you depressed?" "I don't know, Doc. That's why I'm here." Patient after patient would come in without a reason. No loss of a loved one. No trauma. And his conclusion after many years is that these people were suffering from a lack of meaning, a lack of purpose. You could have all the money in the world. You could have all of the luxuries. You could have success. But if at the core of your essence there's a vacuum, if you don't know why you're living, if you're not aware of what life is about, you will be depressed. His position is from a secular psychiatric vantage point, and he certainly is correct, and the Torah tells us why. Because Hashem took the human being, put us into this world to grow and accomplish. Hashem put us into this planet to reach stellar heights, to do tremendous things. When you take a very carefully handcrafted tool and use it to pry open a window, it does a lousy job. When you take a human being who was created to grow, you take a human being who was created to reach heights, and you use him for any other purpose, whether it be to make money or to get honor or to do whatever you may want to do, if he's not growing, if he's not accomplishing, he's going to be empty inside. And if you'd like to see an example of it, look out at America today. Tens of millions of cases of reported clinical depression. Tens of millions of people who can't get out of bed in the morning because, bleh, life stinks. But science now shares with us a phenomenal insight. But a small percentage of those tens of millions of cases have an attributable cause. An attributable cause means a reason for depression. If a woman was married for 30 years and she lost her husband, that's a reason that she should be depressed. If you have a predisposition towards depression, a gift from your family, that's a reason to be depressed. But of the tens of millions of clinical depressions in this country, but a small percentage have an attributable cause. The rest of them just get up in the morning and say, "Ugh, life stinks." What do you mean life stinks? You have money, you have honor, you have position, you have a beautiful life, you're married with a family, you have a home in the suburbs. What more could you dream of? Well, there's a lot more. It's called purpose, it's called meaning, it's called leading a life for some bigger purpose. And you could have all of the luxuries, everything imaginable, but if you're not growing, if you're not accomplishing, if you don't understand why Hashem created you, if you're not leading a life with that purpose in mind, you will be vacuous, you will be empty inside, and is a big black hole. They say that every addiction is an attempt to fill a hole. You're trying to fill a hole in your soul with a substance, whether it be alcohol or cocaine or whatever it may be. There's an emptiness inside that you're trying to fill with something. Fill it, fill it, fill it. And guess what? When you wake up in the morning, the flowers don't smell beautifully. The sights aren't gorgeous because life is black and bleak and bitter. If there's no meaning, there's no purpose, if life doesn't make sense, then you could have all of the luxuries, all of the material wealth, and you're going to feel deeply, deeply depressed. And if you like a parable, I'd like to share with you one. There was a book I read many years ago about a young black fellow growing up in the South in the 1920s. And he describes poverty in his world. He says he went to sleep hungry at night and got up hungry in the morning, and there was no food to quench his hunger. He had constant hunger pangs all day long. One day, on the way to school, he figured out a solution. There was a garden hose. Somebody had left it out. He turned on the spigot and began drinking and drinking to fill his belly, and he succeeded. After a while, he filled his stomach to the point where he no longer felt the hunger pangs. He solved the problem. For 20 minutes till the water passed, and then he was more hungry than he was before. If you'd like to understand our generation, you see people living lives of luxury, living in palaces, but they're empty inside. And they try to fill that emptiness with everything you can imagine. Honors and luxuries and iPods and possessions, and just give me more and give me more. But guess what? When you try to drink when you're hungry, you never get satisfied. And when you take a human being who is crafted to be great, to accomplish, and to lead a life of fulfillment and deep, deep growth, and you use that life for any other purpose other than that, you're going to be empty. You could live in a beautiful world, a world replete with every imaginable feature, so you should benefit from it. But if you're depressed inside, if you're not happy inside, guess what? Ugh, life stinks. And I believe that's exactly pshat in Rabbi Elazar bar Pidas. You see, Rabbi Elazar bar Pidas understood life. When he opened his eyes in the morning, it was with a love for life. 24 hours to change myself and change the world. Let's go. And because he loved life, life was precious. And when Hashem told him, you passed the halfway mark, he was told the bitter news. Oyvei, half of my life, the most precious possession in the world is gone. He began crying. And if you'd like to learn Musar, this is the Musar lesson. I don't know of a human being who had it as rough as Rabbi Elazar bar Pidas. Poverty, disease, illness. He had such a difficult life that when Hashem himself comes to this Amora, and the very first words he says is, Ad Masa Yetzar. He doesn't ask Hashem all of the questions that he probably had. He didn't ask Hashem philosophical questions or halachic questions. He was so consumed by his pain that he said, Hashem, when will it end? And despite living a life of pain, he loved life. He had a tremendous lust for life, and life was precious because he understood it. Never in the course of history has there been such luxuries, freedoms, and material possessions available to the common man. And I dare say that never in the course of history have been this many depressed, unhappy people. We, as the Am HaNivchar, as Hashem's chosen people, have been given a directive. Grow, accomplish, live a Torah lifestyle. It's for the world to come. You'll have a beautiful Olam Haba, but forget the world to come. You'll have a beautiful Olam Hazeh. Your life here will be replete with beauty and enjoyment. You'll look at a sunrise and you'll say, wow, it's beautiful. You'll bite into an apple and you'll say, it's delicious. A grape tastes very different than does a banana, very, very different than does an avocado. Wow, life is sweet. Yes, Hashem created us for the world to come. Yes, that's the purpose. This is but the gym and that's a spa. But Hashem is the mativ, Hashem is the giver, and Hashem wants us to enjoy this world as well. And if a person lives their life properly, they're in sync with themselves, there's an inner harmony, there's an inner joy, life itself is beautiful, and they lead a life of simcha and happiness. They gain this world and the world to come.